Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and today, a podcast that's a little bit different. This is episode CLIII, Livia. Today's podcast will run in two parts. Firstly is a rerun of episode XXV, which originally aired way back in 2016, in which Rhiannon Evans and I discussed the life and times of Livia, wife of Augustus, and first Empress of Rome. This will be followed with, as a very special treat, an interview with the actress Sian Phillips, who portrayed Livia in the 1976 BBC television series I, Claudius. And on that note, here's Rhiannon Evans.
Livia comes from a really important patrician family, and she's born at a very interesting time. She's born in about 58 BCE, which means she comes to adulthood exactly when the Republic is falling apart. So she's from that really aristocratic background. Her father is from the family of the Claudii, the Claudiuses. He's adopted into the Drusus family, so she's often called Livia Drusilla.
That means second child?
It almost certainly does, because the ill bit in Drusilla means little. It's a sort of diminutive, which might mean that she had an elder sister called Livia Drusa. So that was to identify her. But we have no evidence for that sister. We know she had a brother. But as I say, she comes from this big, important Republican family. And that means that she is somebody who's going to be married off to important Roman men.
Her father was a senator?
Her father was. She had consuls in her family. She's got exactly a kind of impeccable patrician background.
What is the role of a young woman in her ranking in that society? Is it simply to be someone to marry off in a bit of a power play, really?
That's often what aristocratic women in Republican Rome were used for, and to a certain extent this continues in Imperial Rome too, that there are a certain very small number of families that really control Roman politics. And even though we have voting at this period and we might think of it as sort of democratic, it's an oligarchy. It's controlled by very, very few. And the way that they bind one another together is through marriage. So they want to make an alliance with another Roman aristocrat. They will marry their sister or daughter to somebody from that family.
So does this happen to Livia then?
Yeah, Livia marries well, as would be expected. She marries a man called Tiberius Claudius Nero, who's also from the Claudian family.
I recognize all of those names, yes.
Yes, yes, they're all going to be significant names in the empire, as we've already really gone through. And they all really come from this man that Livia marries. He doesn't get to be emperor, but he is the father of emperors.
Yeah, yeah. So is he a senator?
Yes, absolutely.
So you say
also patrician.
Also patrician. So this happens all around the fall of the Republic. So which side of the sword does Livia and her husband Tiberius Claudius Nero fall?
The wrong side in every single way. Livia's on the wrong side in terms of who her father backs.
Right.
So her father is on the Republican side, the non-Julius Caesar side in the First Civil War. And then her husband backs the assassins of Caesar. He's not part of the conspiracy to kill Caesar, but afterwards he suggests that the assassins should be congratulated. So obviously he's not on Octavian's side, wanting to get revenge. Then he's also on the wrong side against Octavian. He backs Mark Antony. So all the way along, they pick the wrong person. But it really doesn't seem to matter. When it comes to Livia, she seems to escape all of that scot-free.
So I imagine that it goes quite poorly for them during the Civil War.
They're given amnesties both times. There's a point at which you don't kill off all of your enemies in either of these civil wars, although vast numbers of people were proscribed. Livia's father and husband weren't proscribed. They weren't put on that list where you could kill them with impunity. But her husband did flee to Greece initially and only came back when the amnesty was issued.
So at this point, Livia's got one child, Tiberius, and is pregnant with another. What do we know about her specifically during this period before she comes back from Greece? Is she just along for the ride with her family?
We don't know anything about her. There's very little written about her. And really, all we know comes out in the biography of Augustus, so Suetonius's biography. And of course, Suetonius is primarily interested in her when she meets Augustus in 39 BCE. And he does also talk about her, especially in the biography of Claudius. She's Claudius's grandmother.
Mm.
So she comes up in both of those biographies, but her early life is a bit of a mystery apart from that, except that we know she's married at about 15. And by the time she's 19, she's got one son and another one on the way. So she's about 20 when she gets involved with Augustus, or as he is at that time, Octavian.
Her husband, and by extension her, are granted an amnesty and go back to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
She's married. Augustus is married as well to his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go from meeting somebody who is essentially a traitor and was on the enemy's side to getting married? And that happened really quickly as well.
It did. In fact, it seems to have all happened in 39 BCE. Octavian divorces his wife supposedly on the day that she gave birth to their daughter.
That's really rough.
Julia, that's pretty nasty, isn't it? Except I guess we should remember that divorce is very, very common in the Roman world. And not to say that people didn't always get emotional about it, but amongst aristocratic families, it seems to have been regarded as something that you shouldn't take personally almost. Because marriages are alliances with other families, this could be regarded as Octavian deciding to make a new
alliance. I feel you're making excuses for him.
I know it's very difficult to think of it in those terms. But then marriage and divorce is made for dynastic purposes. It's a very cold way of thinking about it from our point of view, but it's exactly how the Romans did think about it.
So if you're thinking about it from that perspective, then it's strategically wise for Augustus to be married to Livia. Why is that? Is she significant? Is her family a good choice?
Well, I've said you can look at it in a very cold way. She is. I mean, she's from a significant Republican family, so she's definitely not a bad choice. But Suetonius suggests that it is a real love match, and that's kind of why it happens so quickly. He wants to get rid of his wife Scribonia and get married to Livia, that it's almost a love at first sight type. You know, he marries her while she is still pregnant by her first husband, which is very unusual because potentially that leads to all kinds of questions about whose son this is. Now, Octavian never claims that the second son, who's called Drusus, is his, but there were always rumors that Drusus might actually be his love child.
But they waived the waiting time.
They did.
So this is all really rushed. And what did Tiberius Claudius Nero, the first husband, what did he make of all of this?
Well, he was persuaded to get divorced, and we can only imagine that for him this was something pragmatic, given, as we've mentioned, he's on the losing side. This is a way of kind of ensuring that his family's okay, because his sons will become the stepsons of the man who's on the winning side, the one who's going to be a very significant player in Rome. Now, he doesn't know that Octavian is going to become the first emperor of Rome at this point. This is in 39, and it's going to be another 12 years before Augustus comes to real power. And even then, a lot of ancient historians feel, I think quite rightly, that, you know, it's not a done deal until the late 20s, until about 23 BCE. You don't know in 27 BCE that everything's going to be very stable. So it's kind of a gamble, but it's a gamble that pays off because then his family is safe. So he's quite complicit with all of this. In fact, he gave her away at the wedding. So Suetonius says, just as a father would. He basically acts as her father in this transaction. Now, I know, again, that sounds very weird to us, but the Romans actually had two forms of marriage. Livia probably wasn't married under this very ancient form, but the very ancient form actually transferred the woman from her father to the power of her husband, and her husband effectively became her father, the pater familias. The father has all the power in the Roman family, so he has power over his wife as if she's his child in that kind of marriage. That was a very old-fashioned kind of marriage that was rarely practiced by this period. It's not as weird as it sounds to us. Okay. And that's partly because we've got all of this emotional connection to marriage. You can't imagine your ex-husband coming and giving you away at your second marriage.
Yeah,
it's very weird.
Yeah. A very fast marriage. either a Roman love affair or a strategic power play, or perhaps a bit of both.
I think both, yes.
So on the flip side of it, on the other side of the wedding, what sort of married relationship did Augustus and Livia have?
Well, I think the signs are that it was a very successful marriage because, and there's a sort of negative reason for this, the Romans thought the purpose of marriage was to have legitimate children.
Which they didn't have.
They have no children together. There's a miscarriage. They already have children, of course. Augustus has Julia by his previous marriage, and Livia now has two sons. But they don't have any children together, and this would absolutely be grounds for divorce in Roman society. It'd be quite normal for Augustus, as he becomes, to move on and marry somebody else to have more children with, especially because he doesn't have a son. And this is very important for Roman families. But he doesn't do that. So that in itself is a sign that he has a great deal of affection for Livia, that he maintains this marriage for over 50 years.
What do we know about the regard that Augustus held Livia in?
It seems to have been very great. And Livia has more power than any woman we know of previously in Roman society. Now, this is not to say that Republican women never had any power. They probably exerted all kinds of influence. But Livia is given public honors. She is seen more in public. Statues of her are put up so the public can see her. There's a porticus of Livia that's erected, which will obviously have an inscription with her name on it. So she's kind of in your face. You see her if you're in Rome and in other places too. She's given the right to look after her own money. Technically, no Roman woman earned any money. She always had a guardian. But Livia is freed from that guardianship. And there's a law brought in that a woman with three children is freed from that kind of control. She's free from her guardian. Now, Livia doesn't have three children, but she's given that right anyway. So this is another way in which rules are broken a bit for Livia.
How influential was she in Rome then? Did she have a lot of sway with her husband?
She seems to have had a lot of influence over him, but we can't really say exactly how that demonstrated itself, except that he consulted with her, presumably. What we can say is that she's certainly useful and was probably influential on the kind of moral reforms that Augustus brings in. So if you remember back to the Augustus podcasts we did, there is this whole kind of family values that he's interested in. So he makes adultery illegal, that kind of thing. And Livia, by being presented as this perfect wife, is quite useful to him. He sort of trusts her to have this image. I think that indicates trust, that he knows she's not going to let him down there. And she is supposed to have done things like made his clothes for him. She actually wove them. This is what a good Roman woman traditionally does. But obviously, aristocratic women don't have to do that. They've got servants, they've got slaves. But she does it anyway, because that's an important part of her image.
So did she use her position and her influence to further the interests of her two sons?
Absolutely. And this is the main way that we can trace her influence, because both of them are adopted by Augustus and they're set up as heirs, basically, particularly after Augustus's grandsons died, his grandsons by his daughter Julia. And there's no direct line to succeed him. Tiberius is the one who's put forward as the heir from 4 CE. And then, of course, Livia becomes very significant because she's not only the wife of the emperor, she's the mother of the future emperor.
Once her husband dies, it must be hard for a woman to remain relevant and visible in that sort of society, although it would have helped being the mother of the new emperor to some extent. But she seems to have really made her mark and maybe stepped out of Augustus's shadow a bit during this period.
Well, if you think about how long Augustus has been there, he's been princeps or emperor for 41 years by the time he dies. She's kind of an established figure at this point. And she's also left an awful lot of money in his will, and money is power. She gets a third of his estate left to her, and he has, you know, he's enormously wealthy. That's huge. She's also, and this kind of harks back to the whole giving her away as if he's her father, she's adopted by Augustus in his will, which might, again, sound rather strange. But this means that she can now be called, and she is now called, Julia Augusta. So she takes on the female form of Augustus's names. That will actually become an honorific term that's given to a lot of future empresses. So that's an important term. So she's got all of these honors. And as you say, she's now the mother of the current emperor. And she lives for another 15 years.
So she must be a pretty strong reminder then of what was seen as the golden period of Rome.
Not everybody saw it in this way, of course, but it's certainly a time of stability.
Yeah.
And there's a certain amount of gratitude for that. And it's also an institution that is becoming permanent. It's not necessarily permanent at this point, but, you know, that family is becoming kind of solidified.
Romana.
Yeah, the Pax Romana, the fact that you've got an imperial family and she's a good kind of figurehead for that, I suppose.
Yeah. So she's got an established relationship with one emperor, with her late husband Augustus. How does she get on with the new emperor?
Well, a lot of the accounts say not too well. Okay at first, but sometime in the 20s it seems to deteriorate. And as we saw when we did the podcasts on Tiberius, he's a fairly mercurial figure anyway. He can be a bit dour. And according to Tacitus, at the beginning, he sort of refuses lots of titles for himself. For example, Augustus had been father of the country, pater patriae, and he says, no, I don't want that one. And Tacitus has this whole conspiracy theory that this is Tiberius just pretending and he actually wants to be offered flattery. But as an extension of this, Livia is offered the title mother of the country and Tiberius won't let her have it. So he's actually sort of not letting his mother have certain honors that the Senate wants to give her. Tacitus and Dio Cassius do represent her as somebody who wants to be too involved. I guess the implication is that she had had a lot of influence with Augustus and Tiberius gets sick of that. And of course, we know that he goes off into virtual exile in Capri at one point, and the historians theorize that that's because he's sick of Livia. Tacitus says, he says there's a kind of veneer of harmony. And he puts it in a very Tacitian way. He does that thing that we call the invidious alternative. So the quote is, a genuine harmony between mother and son or a hatred well concealed existed between them. So in other words, they made it look like they were in harmony with one another. But actually, it was almost too perfect. They were obviously plastering over something. When Tacitus says that, he wants you to think it's the second one. It is a hatred well concealed. He has a very negative view of her.
So when she dies, how is she remembered? How is she regarded?
Part of how she's remembered is mediated by Tiberius because he won't allow her to be deified. So she's not immediately turned into a goddess, which I think people had expected.
But having said that, it's not normal for a woman of that stature to be turned into a goddess, is it?
Deification and normal is a relative term, isn't it?
Because especially at this time.
If you think about it, there are only two people who've been deified that anyone can remember, Julius Caesar and Augustus. Mm. I guess there's an idea that this will happen to the Augusta. So it's a sort of a snub, but yes, there is no tradition.
But it's a snub as in he actively ensures that it doesn't happen.
Yes. And also, and perhaps more important for the Romans who are obsessed with making wills and being legalistic, he revokes her will. This is kind of her last bit of power. That's what your will is, deciding how your property will be dealt with. And he says, no, we're not going to bother with that.
Wow, real mother issues, eh?
I think so.
Yeah. But this all kind of comes around again when Claudius becomes emperor because he does deify her.
He does. So she gets deified in 42, but that's, 13 years after she dies. She dies in 29. You could think of Claudius in a very pragmatic way that, remember, Livia is his grandmother. So this is a way of kind of solidifying his power. But I think that also makes it clear that all of this time, it's something that people have been sort of expecting, that it's still worth doing even in 42.
So I guess that in some ways shows that her reputation was quite good and it's still intact after that time.
It does seem to have been, certainly amongst a lot of Romans. The historians give her a not entirely positive write-up. Tacitus in particular sees her as a quite invidious person, stepmother to the country, to the nation, he calls her, and stepmothers are never good in Greek and Roman texts. He sees her as somebody very scheming and manipulative. Now, that in itself is kind of interesting when we're talking about Roman women, because the opinion that historians and biographers have of them is that they shouldn't really have power. So in a way, almost every prominent Roman woman that we can ever talk about tends to get a bad rap from Roman historians, because they're by and large aristocratic and very traditional. And the fact that this woman has come to prominence leads them to think that there must be something wrong. The men haven't controlled them enough. Mm. So we don't necessarily have to take Tacitus at his word. He has issues with women, to put it lightly. However, we can't really say that there's an entirely positive image of Livia. There were naysayers. There were people who thought of her as having too much power, as having possibly used that power in quite criminal ways. And, you know, it was suggested that she was responsible for some of the deaths in Augustus's family. So there's that rumor going around in the background.
But on the other side of it, 2,000 years later, now her reputation is quite good. You're in particular quite fond of her, aren't you?
I think Livia's great, but I think that's partly because I think she probably was a schemer. And she probably, like Augustus, she knew exactly how to work with the hand that she was given. They're both coming into power at this time when it could have all gone wrong. And the emperors that we've looked at subsequently, they handle the Roman public and the Roman Senate in different ways, and they all do it wrong in some way. Even Claudius, who's not too bad, he ends up annoying the Senate. He ends up killing senators. Now, Augustus had been responsible for the deaths of many of them in the civil wars. But as we've seen, he issues an amnesty. He manages to keep on the right side of the right number of people so that he's not in danger. He manages to have this period of 40 years of peace. Now, I'm not saying that I think that Augustan Rome would have been the place that I would have wanted to live at all. I don't think I'd want to have been Livia's friend. But I think that she's an admirable person in that she knows how to work the power play. I don't think that Livia was a nice woman, but I think she was a very intelligent empress.
Hello, listeners. Just a quick bit of bridging audio here between what you have just listened to, an interview between myself and Rhiannon Evans discussing the life of Livia, Empress of Rome, and what is about to come. Quicker than boiled asparagus, you will be hearing myself and Rhiannon Evans talk to Sian Phillips, who portrayed Livia in the 1976 BBC television series I, Claudius. Exciting! Here's that interview.
I was wondering how much you knew about Livia or the Roman emperors before you entered into that project.
I didn't know anything, actually. I didn't know anything about Livia. And the BBC in those days was very considerate. They used to lay out long trestle tables in the rehearsal room, because for 7 months you would be in that rehearsal room. And they used to put books out there. So they laid out all the books they could think of, but there wasn't very much on Livia. And they said, I wouldn't bother if I were you, I wouldn't. So I did read everything there was. And I realized that all the men thought she was a mass murderer. They just assumed she was very mad. I only read about three people, Suetonius, and I can't remember the other two. But they all thought she was bad. And then Robert Graves also thought the men were good and the women were rather bad, I think. And then Jack Pullman, bless his heart, who adapted it and recreated a lot of it, he also took that view, rather, that the men were ruined bad women, I thought. So we ignored all that. Herbert Weiss, who was a wonderful director, said, now look, we haven't got the time to have a democratic process, he said. I don't want to hear anyone's opinion during rehearsal. This is how we are going to do it, and it's my word, and my word goes. So no arguments, please, just get on with it. So we couldn't really do it properly because it was against much that we were used to as English actors. He wanted it big, poster paint, definite, simple to understand up there. None of this British stiff upper lip subtlety and you know, none of that. We did, but then after about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I did say, is this a Jewish comedy? And they said, well, we didn't want to say that because we thought you would find it confusing. But yes, it is more or less. So the family meet in that room and they just squabble like mad, you know. So that was really the way, I'm afraid, we approached it.
So when you say as Jewish comedy, are you thinking of yourself as the kind of Jewish matriarch, the mother figure? Yeah.
Trying to rule everybody, trying to rule the roost and letting the men do a bit, you know, but and having lots of rows, obviously, and being very, very for the family.
So did you feel that there wasn't as much room for nuance as you were used to in the theatre?
That's what I thought, or even in television. I really thought so. But Herbert was absolutely right. It was the right style for the play. And Jack Pullman, I think, wrote a wonderful script, which improved on the book, I thought.
It's interesting that you just called it a play then.
Oh, the play. Yeah, well, the script. Each script was like a play, you know. And that was how we did television in those days. We used to rehearse for 3 weeks, go into the studio for 4 days and film the play. And then start rehearsing the next one again. So we didn't do it in bits. We did it in bits, but we did it in the right order all the way through.
Did you have those 4 days just for one episode? Is that all you had?
There was a technical day and a performance day, a technical day and a performance day, because there were three or four cameras always on the floor. They had to keep out of each other's way as well. That had to be rehearsed. So we did 4 days, but only two of actual acting.
3 weeks rehearsal for an episode, is that normal or would that be a lot now?
It would be a lot now, but it was normal then. It wasn't all that much. It was less than, you know, it was 2 weeks really. And then 4 days in the studio, but an hour and a quarter used to get about a week's filming and 3 weeks of studio rehearsal, and then you did the play. So you had a month, and then you did an hour and a half television in the studio. And we never went outside the studio. That was the other big decision, was not to open it up. And I think that was a wise decision, really, not to try, because we were doing complicated open-air things on location, but they decided not to do it with I, Claudius.
All right.
Yeah, so the producer was very, very gifted. Martin Lismore was only, he was killed shortly after the play was aired. And I think he was only 36 when he died. And he was a brilliant, brilliant producer. And he was the head of drama, and it was his decision.
Can you tell us how you got the part? Was it offered to you? Did you audition? What do you remember about that?
And Martin Lismore being the head of drama, I had worked for Martin before. He'd cast me in How Green Was My Valley, which is the Richard Llewellyn book. I had to wear a white wig all the way through, and I was only 30-something myself, I think, or late 30s anyway. So I had to wear a white wig and a cap, and it was a very plain part. I was a bit mopey about that from time to time. He came in on the last day in the studio with a pile of scripts, and he threw them on the makeup table, and he said, how about doing this next then? It was I, Claudius, and I opened it, and it said, she lifts her wizened face towards John Hurt. She lifts her withered face and her claw-like hand extend. And I thought, oh no, Martin, not another one. He said, oh, I think you'll find it more interesting than that. So I read it and I said yes the following morning.
Instant decision. So it was Caligula when he kisses you as his grandmother.
No, I thought it was like that all the way through. I said, oh no.
Actually, that brings up the fact that they had to age you quite a bit, because you start off probably about the age you were.
I had to be younger when I started. And then they took me all the way through to death. Yeah. It took 5 hours to do the makeup in the end.
Wow.
Yes, so we had to go in very early in the morning. It was a very tiring couple of weekends.
I bet. That's another reason to do them in sequence.
Oh, it would have been impossible. And they were very expensive. Those masks, which now, to a technician especially, look very, very crude, were then state of the art. They were the best in the world. Because I remember making a film in Mexico and having to carry the masks from the same maker all the way over to Mexico City for the film, because he was the best mask maker in the world at that point. But they took a long time to put on, and you couldn't eat or drink once they were on. You know, that was it. Everything was through a straw.
I think yours looked great in the show, and so did Brian Blessed with the aging makeup. That went really well.
I was just going to ask you if you'd worked with any of them before, especially with Brian Blessed or Derek Jacobi, because you're sort of associated with them for us after I, Claudius.
I work with them now. I worked with Derek a few weeks ago on a Doctor Who for radio, And I did a show with Brian a few weeks ago. You know, he's very eccentric, Brian. He's given up going up Everest, I think, but he now wants to go into space. He's as free spirit as Brian. And Derek is great, of course, and I'm working like that. We're all working. I knew an awful lot of those actors before we knew each other, which was why we could get on with it relatively fast. I knew John Hurt very well. He was a very close friend. I knew a lot of the girls. It was relatively easy to get on board quickly.
And I wonder whether the character of Livia, you said that all of the men saw her as, saw all of the women, in fact, as these characters who led men to their ruin. Did you foresee or did you, in fact, plan that she would become something of an iconic figure? Because even as she is really manipulative and evil, we sort of sometimes empathize with her in the series.
Yes, we do. I mean, she did do it all for her family. You know, she was looking after her own. No, I didn't. None of us did. We knew it would be good, but we were making it in a rather unusual way because of Herbie Wise's idea of what the style should be. And when new people came into the show, they would be sent to look at the footage of what we had shot before, so they would get a quicker idea of how to do it. So they would come to work. They'd say, go over to the studio and look at that. So they'd go away and they'd come back. And because we knew each other quite well, we would catch each other's eye. And I remember several people coming back into the room and going, because they didn't think it was going to work. So we were fairly confident after a bit that it was going to be good. All those Masterpiece Theatre series were good. You know, there was a standard below which they didn't fall. But we had no idea it was going to be popular. Well, the first I realized that the nature of it was when afterwards I was walking down the road in London and a taxi driver wound his window up and said, "Hi, Livia." Well, now I thought, oh, there's something happening here that I don't understand. And indeed, when I went to Israel to do a cabaret tour, I was standing outside my hotel and my interpreter was not coming with me that morning. So I was in the taxi. And the taxi wasn't moving. And finally, the driver wound his window down and said something to the interpreter, who laughed. And I said, "What did he say?" And he said, "Is that Augustus's wife in the back?" Well, no, that's an Israeli taxi driver. Why do taxi drivers probably see everything?
That's a wonderful story. The kind of representation that Livia has in those ancient texts is so entirely one-sided and so much driven by this, often just implications that she was involved in possible murders.
As far as I remember, the idea of family was terribly important in Roman society. So her position and her public appearance would be immensely important. And she was a good wife. She was intelligent, she was beautiful, she was kind, she was gracious, she was all those things, as far as they knew. I think she merited a statue, didn't she, at one point, which is very unusual for women in Rome, that she got a statue. So she must have been quite important in her own right, because she was allowed to administer her own affairs, for example, and women weren't allowed to do that. Women were given tutors in order to teach them how to do bits and pieces in public life. Well, she didn't have any of that, but she just did it. So she must have been very, very, very intelligent, I think. Very clever. Yeah,
extremely astute, because one of the things that, sorry, I don't want to go into lecture mode here, but certainly one of the things that's often said about Roman marriages is that if there are no children of the marriage, then that's a kind of easy case for divorce. And of course, Augustus and Livia didn't have any children together, although they both had children separately and Augustus could adopt her sons. But clearly she was such an important figure to him that he never even considered that.
They were married for the whole of his career, the whole of his reign. And she was very young when they got married. And I don't think he would have married her for her brains entirely, because he went and snaffled her rather, didn't he, from her other husband. So he wouldn't have known how smart she was then, I shouldn't think, anyway. And she probably developed a great deal during the marriage, I would imagine.
She was in a very difficult position. So somebody asked me recently, what's the difference between, actually with you, Matt, an empress and a first lady? I was just realising we made a podcast about empresses. Of course, the position of First Lady is a sort of analogue for a Roman Empress, but Livia was the first, and so she had to create that role.
Like creating a monarchy, isn't it? The movement was almost like that. I don't know why they gave me the part, actually, because I had a lot to learn quite fast. And I remember there were days when we would have crowd scenes with lots of slaves and servants. And I had to do a long walk down several rooms, through several rooms, quite fast, because I wanted to go somewhere. And Herbie was coming alongside, and they were doing a tracking shot with the camera. And Herbie was saying, "Sean, Sean, kick a slave, kick a slave." Which went against the grain. Oh, God. I had to learn to kick a few slaves and to walk up doors as though they would open. You know, there'd be these huge doors and you just march up to them as though you're going to walk through them, because they will open, or sit down anywhere because there will be a chair. You know, those things were very difficult. Well, I had to learn them rather quickly. I think they're called master-servant relationships in drama schools, and I must have missed that class, you know, because I was a bit slow on that.
I'm sure it means that you're a nice person, that it didn't come naturally to you.
Well, I'm not as happy as Livia, that's for sure.
You certainly come over as very patrician in that series, and it's exactly right.
Yes, quite.
So was there anything that you wanted to get across as Livia that came from you? I was wondering how much of Sean we can see in the role.
No, there wasn't. It was all written down. The scenes with John Hurt, her death, you know, whenever you get a film or a play or a part, you can tell very quickly where you shouldn't do too much acting, where you should just be the character and get on with it and not do acting. But there are a few places in every show, if it's a big, big part, where you have to do a bit of acting. And there were various spots in I, Claudius, where I knew I had to do a bit of acting. One of them was the death scenes with John Hurt, with Caligula. I had to do a bit of acting there. And Herbie didn't do any directing. He just let us do it, and we did it, and we shot it, you know. So that wasn't written down.
That was a very powerful scene, that one. Also, Augustus's death scene, which is all you talking with the camera on Brian Blessed.
Yeah, that was such a clever idea. I was a bit put out at that point, actually, that particular day, because I'd learned that very, very long speech. And then I realised I needn't have bothered learning it, really. No, that was such a clever idea to do that, I think.
I have to wonder now, if you don't like somebody, do you leave some figs on their doorstep or something like that? Or
that's chilling.
Terrible. I refer to it a lot when I go abroad or I'm working somewhere. They will say in French or in German or whatever, "Please say the line about the figs."
Really? Is that still happening? So it's still
happening. It happened the other day, actually. I was somewhere and they said, somebody from the back of the audience said, "Could you just say the line about the figs?"
Does it annoy you to have to keep repeating?
No. It always takes me by surprise, but it just makes me laugh.
I know this is a bit trivial compared to some of the questions that or some of the issues we've been talking about, but did it take long to do your hairstyle? Because Roman women's hairstyles are sort of a big deal for
it is. I didn't like it because they were so flat. You know, they were so flat. I kept saying, "My face is so long. I can't have flat hair as well." And they said, no, you've got to do it this way. The BBC had a department, a floor of its own in the basement of White City, where the makeup went on and the hair and everything. And they ruled the roost. You know, you weren't allowed to touch a hair once it was done. It was a bit like the National Theatre. Once they prepared you, you're not allowed to change it. Oh, hours and hours it spent to do those wigs. Even the bald wig at the end, took a long time. You know, and she only had a few little hairs coming out. They went to a lot of trouble. I know I didn't bother much with that, but they dyed the fabric themselves in the building, you know, in order to get the right colours, exactly the right shades. And they went to a heck of a lot of trouble.
They look very good. And certainly there have been films made since then where they like to dress the women in very revealing clothing, which I don't think I, Claudius, was interested in, thank goodness. I think you're probably glad that they didn't go too authentic, because it would almost certainly have been wool. It would have been very heavy.
It was very frumpy, I think. Yes, it was. We felt frumpy even in those days. They were frumpy compared with some of the costumes.
Well, respectable Roman women were meant to wear a gown that basically went from here down really? To you can't I see don't, their feet. Don't. And very, very kind of, yeah, it would have been frumpy.
But they were so bunchy around the top. I mean, there was no shape to them at all. They just tied them with, oh, it was, yeah. But we didn't like that much. We got used to it.
Most of what we associate with Livia now is a result of your role. I don't think we were supposed to entirely like your character, but I wanted to know more about her on the show than I wanted to know about Claudius.
Yeah. I tell you what was good about her, that I think that makes her appealing in the middle of it. There was a lot of comedy in it. There was a lot of laugh. So, you know, the scenes with the poisoning, the woman who comes, they discuss poisoning, you know, the technical forms of poisoning. That is a terribly funny scene. I think that's the thing about Livia. She does have a sense of humour. My Livia had a sense of humour anyway, which maybe she didn't have.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I think that is why we come to like her despite ourselves as viewers, because she's enjoying herself, I suppose. Doing things that people shouldn't enjoy, but she's full of gusto.
Yeah, she does relish the evil, you know. And also she's so convinced she's doing the right thing that it's funny. You know, it's ridiculous. So.
Yes, and she would, I guess, rationalise it to herself as also doing the best for Rome. It's the best for her family and the best for Rome.
So you can understand her, really. Well, I understood her anyway.
Is that important to understand a character, even if they are rather malevolent like Livia when you're playing them?
I think so. I think you always have to be able to make a case for your character in court, you know? You have to be able to speak up for them, whatever happens. But it was a very relaxed show to do. It, although we were in a rush, it was very intense, the whole thing. And it went on for 7 months, I think. It was easy because we all knew each other and because Herbie was so definite in what he wanted. And because we had Jack there as well, the writer was there all the time. We had wonderful Betty Willingale, who was the script editor, who allowed no deviation at all from the written word. And we had even had Robert Graves there, you know, and it was a very enjoyable, like a lot of those Masterpiece Theatre shows. It was an enjoyable, intense, very hardworking, but lovely period in everybody's life, I think.
I didn't realise that Robert Graves was there. That's really interesting. Was he allowed to comment or was he just an observer?
He was by that time not sure where he was. He was not. He came and he was charming and he had lunch. I think he went home and round about tea time, he asked his wife when he was going to come to the set, you know, it was rather sad. So although as he got older, his mind went, but he got more and more statuesque and wonderful looking. So he looked like a god when he came in. He looked amazing and used to walk to get the paper in his home. And his mind failed quietly and he became more and more and more strong and wonderful looking.
I was wondering whether there was anything that we wanted to just finish up with, Matt.
I would like to know why Xian didn't get top billing in the show.
Oh, that's very simple. At the time, I was getting top billing in shows previously. And my agent was a wonderful agent. She was very creative, but she was extremely absent-minded. And she did confess to me that she had forgotten to negotiate billing. And if your agent doesn't negotiate the billing, they don't do anything about it. They don't say, hey, shouldn't you be negotiating billing? They just don't bother. So it was just a mistake. Yeah, I know. I used to get billing before and after I Claudius, but not during.
We need to go back and re-edit it so that Sean Phillips' name comes first.
Well, it didn't come first, but it should be over the title, but it didn't.
You moved the snake out of the way, put your name there. That was myself, Rhiannon Evans, and Sean Phillips discussing Livia, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighborhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, and in the next episode, we'll be discussing Messalina, wife of Claudius. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.